Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, all the big international stories. Wembley, England's Shimi Hendrick experience. Playoff finals. Wales with Finns go swimmingly, as you'd expect, but here come Poland. We'll be asking, did France-Germany have the vert start to a game imaginable, or was that in the Austria one earlier that afternoon? And addressing many other big, big questions in this Totally Football Show. Listener, listener, thank you so much for joining us today. Sunday the 24th of March as we record this. Slightly different show for you on account of A, we're not in the studio, and B, we're just Daniel Story and Seb Stafford-Bloor. Hello to you both.
Hi, James.
Hello, Jimbo.
Hello. I have to say, if I had to pick just two to carry us through an international break report stroke roundup, it would be Seb Stafford-Bloor and Daniel Story.
That's lucky.
But just to make sure, we're going to throw in a little bit of Tom Williams later on, and I think we might be getting a call from Christophe Terreur as well, which is always fun. Meantime, Seb, let me ask you, where have you been and what you've been up to since we last spoke?
I have been mainly in Germany. I've been watching most recently a little bit of international football. I've been getting very invested in the coefficient, Jimbo, generally. I didn't see that in my future, but actually I've become kind of, not sure there's a sort of a noun for someone that's interested in coefficients. Well, there might be, but it might be quite unflattering.
There is one. It's a coefficionado.
Oof, nice.
I think it's on every right-thinking person's mind that's not busily occupied with the little crosses on the backs of collars. Daniel, speaking of which, you went to Wembley on Saturday.
Yeah, 2 hours off flag chat. It was nice to see some actual football. Not a brilliant game or brilliant result, but there were things to think about.
Paper planes?
There were certainly paper planes, MIAs, paper planes, yeah.
Nice. All right, well, we'll talk about that. Seb, we're obviously going to get your thoughts on the extraordinary France-Germany result the other night as well, and loads of other things as well, including those Euro 2024 playoff finals, which are coming up on Tuesday. But let's begin with events at Wembley and this.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Tentou levantamento por dentro, Andreas Pereira. Boa bola, buscando Vinícius. Bota na frente, Vinícius. Faz, Vini. Pickford, Hendrick.
Wow, over 10 seconds that goal there. Impressive stuff. Impressive stuff. 17-year-old substitute Hendrick settling the game with 10 minutes to go. Of course, he is Real Madrid bound. But in the meantime, what a game for him. What a game for who else? Daniel Story, what kind of a game was it?
What a game for me, yeah. It was an emphatic international friendly. It was slow paced to start with, and it was broken up by mistakes and sort of flashes of excellence, I suppose. Brazil were really good in the counter, and I think the kind of overarching theme of the game is that everybody got what they wanted. They wanted Declan Rice as the only holding midfielder. So two adventurous central midfielders in Jude Bellingham and Conor Gallagher, the kind of runner and the baller. And it turns out if you only play one defensive midfielder who also wants to surge forward like he does for Arsenal, then you leave a slightly one-pace central defence open to counter-attacks. I've long been a believer that playing two defensive midfielders is not defensive if it allows everybody else to play without the fear and stay up front and kind of press high without worrying about not winning the ball. And that basically seemed to be what happened. Bellingham and Foden seem to occupy probably the same position. I think, if anything, it summed up just how important Harry Kane and Bukayo Saka are, both as a combination and as very complimentary this is intended as, but as place fillers, because Kane is the man up front. Saka is the man on the right. England basically didn't have a right side attack as soon as Kyle Walker went off because they brought on a central defender to fill in. And Foden and Bellingham didn't really want to go there. Gallagher tried. We won quite a lot of free kicks there, but nothing really happened from that side. And it left Anthony Gordon to try and do all of that by himself, which he wasn't really able to do. I mean, by the end, England were pretty ramshackle. You know, he had Joe Gomez at left back, Ezri Konsa at right back. He had Maino making his debut. It looked after about 75 minutes that England were quite happy for the game to have ended at that point.
You mentioned having Declan Rice as the sole defensive midfielder. And what were the other questions or the other issues going into this game for England? And to what extent have any of them been settled?
I don't think any of them have been settled. It was one of those kind of classic nights where the people who aren't there put forward their case more than the people who are. I'm thinking of Luke Shaw over Ben Chilwell at left back because he struggled. I'm thinking of another central midfielder, and it might well be Kobbie Mainoo if he starts against Belgium and does well. Kane and Saka, as I mentioned, both don't need their reputations enhancing, but probably were by what they saw. England have got a central midfield issue. They've got a fullback problem, which is mad because it was only 2 years since we were all picking teams of 11 right backs that England could play, and suddenly we're a little bit unsure about the balance there. And the questions about central defence don't really go away. This will sound absolutely mad as a setup, but England played North Macedonia last year at home, and they played a central midfield of Trent Alexander-Arnold, Jordan Henderson and Declan Rice. And then before the game, everyone went mad on Twitter, as they're prone to do, because we're playing three defensive midfielders against North Macedonia. What are we doing? This is classic Southgate. And what actually happened is that England won 7-0 because the fullbacks could get forward and stay high. It was Walker and Shaw there who are our best.
It was also North Macedonia.
It was, but North Macedonia are... The point is that everyone says when England play weaker teams, that's when we should attack. But you don't, in international football, you don't just attack. You have a game plan that protects the weakest part of your side, which is central defence, with protection. And you allow the strengths to be magnified by getting the fullbacks high, allowing Saka and Foden to come in field, get close to Kane, let Bellingham have some space to roam and to do exactly what he does. And to be fair, did again on Saturday night. He was England's best player. It isn't defensive if it allows everyone else to fly. And we saw last night with just Rice there, he desperately wants to get on the ball and move forward when he gets it. But when he does that, he had periods of time when there was basically six England players 40 yards from Brazil's goal. And then this massive gap to Harry Maguire and John Stones, who are, you know, their vibe is not defending with 40 yards of space in front of them.
Seb, did you see this game?
Yeah, I saw most of it, Jimbo. And I just want to pick up on something that Dan said, actually, because I think it's a disease that is shared by international teams across the world, in that we get preoccupied with positions rather than roles within sides. And so in England's case, we kind of look at the definition of those three players picked in midfield, and we don't worry enough really about kind of what their function is within a team. And to me, that eight role with England has been a problem for a really long time, because it's kind of... it's between Declan Rice and Jude Bellingham. There exists this kind of hinterland into which we just put a guy who is a sort of shuttler, a jack of all trades. And it doesn't ever feel like that role adds to the team composition in a particularly compelling way. I also, at times, I hate to say this, and I'm going to sound terribly negative, it felt like I'd woken up 15 years ago, just in terms of watching England struggle with ball retention. And what they did with it was like, do you remember when you'd watch England back in those, you know, back after the millennium turn, and you'd think they're doing an impression of a side who've been told to keep the ball and who understand that retention in international football is really, really important. And when you compare it with a Brazil, with a team who, I don't think Brazil are the very best team in the world at the moment, but there's a kind of a technical level which I think England don't quite have in certain positions. It's quite unflattering, and it alarmed me. I think Dan hit the nail on the head. It was a game in which you learnt nothing, in which you kind of felt better about nothing, in which you kind of reaffirmed your understanding that Kane is the reference point for so much of that attack. When nothing has really happened, you need the momentum, the little pulses of influence that Bukayo Saka can provide. And that defence is, I don't quite have the vocabulary for it, because it's more a lack of trust. You never really feel like you're going to get through difficult times in a game where like you're being examined defensively. You never feel like that England defence is capable of surviving those periods without making a mistake or without giving up a chance. And that's, it's quite concerning.
The positive spin on that, and this is a kind of if everybody's fit and Kobbie Mainoo impresses against Belgium and he becomes the de facto Jordan Henderson replacement, there is a situation where that works in that Stones and Walker really know each other. Maguire and Shaw really know each other. Mainoo is also Manchester United and therefore takes the ball from them. Declan Rice has played a lot of caps now. He knows that role. I think there is a way that the two sides of that defence in possession are able to build. You saw it a little bit between Stones and Walker last night, that kind of pass, and suddenly it's at Declan Rice's feet in 20 yards of space. It didn't happen often enough. But when players are absent, and they've been very absent recently for England, we have, as much as you can have an injury crisis and for an international friendly, England kind of had one in this break without Saka and Kane, and with Shaw injured and with Walker going off, there were just too many pieces missing after the first 20 minutes of the game for, even at that point, I kind of felt like this is going to be a long 70 minutes to try and work out what happens.
One positive that you mentioned in your piece for the Eye, Daniel, is that much like classic England-Brazil games of yore, you had technically gifted attacking midfielders being roughed by the opposition. Only nowadays, you know, the roles are reversed. It's the Brazilians doing it to us, which is nice. What other glints of light could you see in amongst of all this? Anthony Gordon, how did you feel about his performance?
Yeah, I think he played pretty well. I don't think he makes the starting team in the Euros by any means, because I think the way that Foden and Bellingham tend to operate in the same space means that you probably have to have Foden out on the left. As long as Shaw's there to overlap, he can then dip in field, and then Saka on the right stretches the game wide. What they were incapable of doing last night is stretching the game wide. So they ended up trying to stretch it from back to front. They tried to create the space in midfield by having the separate parts of the team a very long way away from each other. When Saka's there and he stays wide, England are really good at stretching the game wide. And what you have then is Kane is that focal point, like Seb says, in the middle. And you have Bellingham running in from deep. And Foden sort of operates in that slightly positionless position where he's out on the left, but he's drifting in. And when it works and we play quickly, it looks really, really good. And it's looked really, really good recently. Look, we should say this is the first game England have lost since the World Cup in 2022. They've beaten Italy home and away in that period of time. They've looked really good for periods of time. The problem is that, as we know with England, when two steps forward is met by one step back, the one step back tends to linger in the national consciousness more than anything else.
Does it really constitute a step back, though, if it's just a friendly against Brazil?
I think it only does if they lose to Belgium on Tuesday, because I don't think managers always talk about these periods of time as like when you're finding things out about players. And that's probably true, for example, with Mainoo and Gordon. But you also need to build up some momentum going into a national tournament. England have been very, very good under Southgate at building that momentum in a group stage. Certainly at the last World Cup, certainly at World Cup 2018, less so in Euro 2020 because they were sluggish in that group stage, but then they kicked on in the knockouts. But look, I don't think last night has any bearing on the Euros in any way. I think we are one of a number of teams that can win that tournament. I think it will be incredibly fine margins. There are doubts about England's game management if they go ahead. There are doubts about their ability to beat high-class opponents. But yeah, Southgate for himself, for his own mood, I think could do with a decent win on Tuesday night.
Okay. Belgium then. Belgium on Tuesday night. Belgium, who haven't been beaten in 11 matches, are now under the tutelage of Domenico Tedesco, of course. Joining us to tell us a bit more than those bare facts is Christophe Terreur. Christophe Terreur, how are you?
I'm fine, and you?
Yeah, very well. It's been a stressful week. We've been fretting over flags and being beaten by Brazil. What have you been worrying about in Belgium?
Not a lot. Only it's cycling week in Belgium. So everybody's worried about cycling, not about those friendly games of football, to be fair.
Okay. I was wondering about maybe the desecration of your national kit with that Tintin homage where they got the colour of the trousers.
Oh, yeah, but that was weeks before. Okay. So it was already leaked a few weeks ago. So then the discussion was there. A lot of people seem to like it.
I like it.
In Belgium, yeah.
Although I do agree that they should have gone full kit and got the trousers in as well, you know, tucked in above the socks.
And they should have hired Kevin De Bruyne as the model for the kit, so it would have been the complete picture as he was compared to Tintin when he was younger, when he still had another haircut, not the one he has now. So.
Right, Mario Götze was always my kind of go-to Tintin comparison, but I take your point. That works as well. Hey, here's something else you could be concerned about if it wasn't for all the cycling. The 0-0 with the Republic of Ireland this weekend.
Yes, I heard Roberto Tedesco already make a mistake that a famous TV reporter made when he interviewed him a few weeks ago. He called Domenico Tedesco Roberto Tedesco, you mix up the former manager with the new manager. So Domenico Tedesco said that he was waiting for the final whistle for 90 minutes. So that's basically how everybody felt who watched that game. It was just a very dull and slow game. Yeah, with a team that has never played together. So with players that some of them don't play a lot at their team. So it was just a little experiment. And I always see those stories, five things you learned from a game. Maybe they should have done five things you didn't learn from this game. Because there was not a lot to learn about, to be fair.
Five things you could have been doing instead of watching this game. It could have gone worse for Belgium, though. Republic of Ireland with a penalty that was saved by Nottingham Forest's very own Matt Sells. But just going back to Belgium, the wildly disappointing, I think, for many of the Belgian performance back at the World Cup. And for those of us who haven't really been keeping tabs on the side since then, what kind of form is Belgium in with the Euros in prospect?
Well, we've been fine in the qualification, but that was something that was already happening under Roberto Martinez, where we were the champions of the qualification games. We won we always won everything, or we draw. We were always unbeaten. We're still unbeaten with Belgium, I think, in the run of Tedesco. So, you don't know where you are basically until you've met the big guns at a tournament. I think this team is far younger now. We've lost, if I can count, Toby Alderweireld at the back. We've lost Thibaut Courtois after a row with Tedesco about the captain's armband. We lost Axel Witsel. We lost Eden Hazard. So we lost a bit of world-class quality of the team. We have some young guys, but they're not ready yet. And it's a bit of a chaotic team. We can hurt a lot of teams because the attack is quite good. If you have Jeremy Doku, if you have Romelu Lukaku in good form, if you have Kevin De Bruyne and an unpredictable guy like Bakayoko who plays for PSV at the right, or Leandro Trossard of Arsenal, or Luke Bakio of Sevilla, you have lots of players that can create something, but you're quite vulnerable at the back. If Jan Vertonghen at the age of 37 is still your best defender, you might have a problem, although Italians might say different because they became European champions a few years ago with all players at the back. So let's see. But the level is a bit lower than it was before. We are used to having like 18 players in the squad playing for the top five in the Premier League 5 years ago and 6 years ago at the World Cup. Now they're all, most of them, playing for relegation teams. So that's the big difference, I think.
Mm. All right. Some exciting names in there, as you say. What do you think Tedesco is looking to find out from this game against England?
Well, it might be the first real test for his side. We played Germany a year ago. That was basically the best football we've seen from Belgium in a few years. Not anymore under Roberto Martinez since the World Cup. It was fast. It was basically furious game when in the first half hour we scored three times against Germany. But then in the games after, you find out that Germany wasn't that good over the last year. So, maybe it will be the first test for this Belgian side. See how stable our defence is against her. We shall call England a world-class team. They have far more talent at the moment than we have. There will be the test for the defense, I think, basically. We still have no Kevin De Bruyne in the squad. He's injured again, so he hasn't been there for a year now. So, we don't know where we are. And Romelu Lukaku, our second big gun, is not 100% fit. I think he will play against England, but he's struggling with a hip injury for weeks already. So if you're both top players, and I'm not top fit, it's just a friendly game where you can find out some things, but we will only know how strong we are when we play with Kevin De Bruyne, I think.
Okay. The issues with Thibaut Courtois, who's likely to be the goalkeeper for Belgium at the Euros then?
Well, it's Koen Castells of Wolfsburg. He always used to be the better of Thibaut Courtois in the at Genk in the youth. So he was a big prospect when he was a kid, but then he was always injured at the wrong time, basically. He got a finger injury, then Thibaut Courtois made his debut at the age of 16. He was when one of the goalkeepers didn't have his license due to transfer issues. In the preseason, Koen Castells was injured. Thibaut Courtois got his chance at the age of 18. And since then, he's grown to be a top keeper. And Castells, yes, he hasn't made the career everybody expected of him. He moved to Hoffenheim in Germany, did well over there, and then moved to Wolfsburg. But Wolfsburg is not the big side anymore when Kevin De Bruyne was there, when they were still challenging for trophies. So he's a good goalkeeper, but he's been injured for the last week. So he has a shoulder injury. So it's not sure if he plays against England. Otherwise, if he won't be playing against England, it will be Nottingham's Mats Sells again. So good at penalties, we've seen. So, but Koen Castells will be normally number one. We had a huge discussion in Belgium a few weeks ago when Milis Vilar of AS Roma, he's born in Belgium. He has a double nationality, Serbia. He rejected a call-up for Serbia. And everybody thought, oh, Milis Vilar might join the Belgian team. We have our successor for Courtois. But then it was not possible to change nationalities again for him at the age, because he played an international game for Serbia after the age of 22, and the rules have changed a few years ago. So that's a shame, but that says everything about the goalkeeper discussion. Everybody's a bit doubting the goalkeepers at the moment. Is Castells good enough to replace Courtois? No. Maybe he will prove everybody wrong at the Euros, but we'll have to see.
Okay, we will. Meanwhile, Mats Sells, do you think, on Tuesday. Christoph, thank you so much for that. I hope you enjoyed the Tuesday evening, and I look forward to catching up with you ahead of the Euros this summer.
Yes, with Kevin De Bruyne, then hopefully. Otherwise, we'll go out in the first round or something.
Christoph Terreur on England's next opponents. As I say, I didn't think England were that bad in the first half against Brazil, and it was Brazil and all that. Daniel, you were speaking to Natalie Gedra post-game at Wembley. What did she think?
Well, we spoke more at half-time when she was pretty worried about, I think, three of Brazil's back four had not played for their country before. And so she was worried about England threatening that back four and was pleasantly surprised that that hadn't really happened. We should say, if England have got an injury crisis and so do Brazil, they're basically missing their spine in terms of Neymar and Casemiro and Thiago Silva. None of those three were there. And they played pretty well. I mean, I think if Harry Kane had been playing, England probably would have taken the lead before Brazil did. But Endrick became the story, which was really nice. You know, he is so small. When he came on the pitch, I know Mainoo is small, and that was vaguely amusing as well. But the best way I can describe it is that Endrick's shorts and the Brazil shorts are big and very, very bright white. His shorts look bigger than his shirt, which is just a mad thing to see. But he took his goal really well. The Brazil fans at that end of Wembley, where he scored, were really good all night. They went mad all night, and they kind of had their moment. It was brilliant for him. He's obviously a superstar talent. He's already got the move, so we don't even need to kind of talk about him and kind of remember the name. I think everyone's been doing that since he was about 12. He took the goal really well, and his arrival into the game seemed to spark Brazil in a way that hadn't really happened before. They weren't really in the game. Vinicius is kind of going through this thing with Brazil where he's kind of desperate to impress. And he says it's just not working. I've played really badly for the national team. I need to do better. And he was almost trying to take that on himself last night. I thought him and Lucas Paqueta were the standout players. Paqueta in the first half, largely because he was, seemed to be trying to break Jude Bellingham's shins, but also because he played a couple of beautiful passes. He kind of does this thing where he just turns and then passes straight away and surprises a defence. He did that for one chance that set Brazil through on goal. They were better than I thought they would be, Brazil, last night, because it was such a changed team. It was such a young team in terms of international experience. But you look at that, and Seb was talking earlier about like England lacking that eight. Like, Brazil had Bruno and Paqueta, who are basically both exactly what England need in that role. Either of them would be fine, please. Because, yeah, they have this way of dominating the ball and buying time for their teammates and picking the right decision every time, that Conor Gallagher is game without the ball but doesn't really do in the same way with it.
Well, Brazil, of course, have their own big summer tournament coming up. It is the Copa America, which saw this weekend the last couple of nations qualifying. Canada managed to get past Trinidad and Tobago to qualify for their first ever Copa America. Costa Rica took the last place with a 3-1 win over Honduras. Lovely stuff. Tim Vickery was tweeting that Endrick came off the field and cited Bobby Charlton in his reaction to scoring at Wembley, which is quite a thought, given that he's, what, 17?
Yeah, he also, there's quotes from him about Chelsea as well, kind of very much talking up like English Premier League heritage and big London clubs. And I sort of thought, talk about a guy that's running quick before he walks, because he's not even joined Real Madrid yet. That's the good stuff, talking about a move before you've even gone to Real Madrid.
Well, supposedly he could have gone to Chelsea not long ago. The Bewley administration in its wisdom felt that was in no way. But yes.
If you are a young Brazilian player, then Real Madrid just becomes your destination now, because it's socially, it's easier to make the adjustment. And you have so many players who've kind of trodden that path before and overcome the expectation of moving to a club like that straight out of Brazil. Vinicius is a great example. Like, we knew about Vinicius when, I think, when he was 15 years old, and everybody heard about this guy who could never possibly be worth the money. And it was one of those, you know, every now and again, football has one of those moral panics over transfer fees for young players. Well, every now and again, every other week. And Vinicius was a classic example. So obviously their scouting network through Jan Kalafat is well known, but you have a kind of community that you can step right into as a Brazilian player. And so, you know, to go there makes sense. I mean, I applaud him for looking that far down the line, to kind of plotting where he goes next, and, you know, maybe preemptive celebration of future teams, you know, not celebrating too much against Chelsea in the Champions League possibly. But yeah, it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling situation though, which it's pretty handy when you're dealing with that kind of talent.
Indeed so. Very good. Look forward to seeing more from him. England against Belgium on Tuesday. Also that night, there's going to be the Euro 2024 playoff finals, so let's get on to them next.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Tuesday brings the three finals with three places up for grabs at this summer's Euro Championships. At 5 o'clock UK time, there's Georgia against Greece. Then you got Ukraine against Iceland. And in Cardiff, Wales against Poland. Joining us now from the Principality, Tom Williams.
Hello, James.
Williams the Thomas.
Williams the Thomas, coming to you live from sunny Rose-on-Sea on the glorious North Wales coast.
Oh, magnificent. All right. Tom, you also join us from a very happy place, one game from another major continental tournament.
Yes, indeed. Victory over Poland on Tuesday, and Wales will be back at another major tournament. And I think a feature of the last few years with the Welsh national team has just been thinking that, you know, this is fun while it lasts. It won't last forever. And I think if you go back to the World Cup, you know, Wales obviously qualified first time since 1958 and all that, but was so bad. And I don't think anyone really enjoyed Wales' performances in Qatar. I don't think any Wales fans did. And there was a real feeling of an end of an era. You know, Gareth Bale announces his retirement shortly afterwards. Aaron Ramsey had quite a poor tournament. Rob Page is kind of limping on in the dugout. And it did feel like things had reached a kind of end point. And yet, you know, here we are 18 months on or whatever it is. And there's a freshness, there's a vibrancy, and there's a, you know, a new group of players who are leading this team forward.
Indeed. Well, let's talk about the game the other night. Still a little bit hoarse from the Finland encounter. Wales powering past, thanks to Brennan Johnson and David Brooks, Nico Williams, Daniel James and Rhys Iffens, of course, as well.
Yes, yeah. As someone on Twitter pointed out, Wales are in very real danger of running out of Welsh actors to deliver rousing pre-match speeches. I think one suggestion was that we might have to start running through the cast of Fireman Sam. But yes, Rhys Iffens was on hand to do the honours prior to the Finland game. I must admit, I was relatively optimistic prior to the Finland game because, I mean, you know, Finland hadn't looked particularly brilliant in qualifying. I suppose you could probably say the same thing about Wales. But, you know, home advantage once again. Fantastic atmosphere at Cardiff City Stadium. Dream start to the game. David Brooks volleying Wales ahead in the third minute after Harry Wilson's shot had been saved.
Wilson. Hoy, Mind, Wilson! Arbenjan Kempes! Ond un digon da! A ma David Brooks! Di'r hoi'r cychwyn perffaith! Perffaith I Gymru!
And I think Wales generally controlled most of the game from that point on. You know, got a second goal, Nico Williams, lovely free kick into the top right corner from Harry Wilson's layoff. And then Finland scored right on half-time. You know, worst possible time, Teemu Pukki sneaks in and slots one past Danny Ward. So there was a degree of nervousness during the half-time interval. But then, you know, Wales get a third goal through Brennan Johnson right at the start of the second half. And then, from that point on, it was very comfortable. Dan James comes on, runs through, rounds the keeper to score the fourth. And, yeah, pretty straightforward evening, really. And you know, obviously now the terrain will become a little bit steeper with Poland coming to town. But I think, you know, given the way that Wales played, home advantage again, the fact that these players, you know, just despite it being a very young squad, have got so much experience of these kinds of games, I think there's a real optimism, you know, going into this game again.
Mm. Yeah, well, 2 years ago, we were having this conversation prior to Ukraine, though. And that all went okay. And through you went to the World Cup, where in a group of England and Iran and USA, you took 1 point. This time, getting past Poland would earn you a place alongside Austria, the Netherlands and France. Quite the prospect. You do have to get past Poland, who Do you have a good record against Poland, Tom?
I can't even think the last time we played Poland, to be honest.
Well, you've played them a lot.
There aren't any... Oh, have we? Right, okay, go on. Put me out of my misery, James.
Dating back to 2001, you've played them 6 times and you've lost all of them.
That's probably why I don't remember them. I've probably made a conscious or perhaps unconscious decision to block out those memories.
Why do you think this might be different?
Because I'm just looking at the dates of those games, and most of them were in the dark days of the pre Gary Speed, Chris Coleman eras. Did lose to them twice in the Nations League, I know. Yeah, no recollection of those games whatsoever. I think because there's a new dynamic to this Wales team, and there's a real sort of consistency and continuity in terms of selection. You look at the team that started against Finland on Thursday, and on paper it was a very young team, but Ethan Ampadu was winning his 50th cap at the age of only 23, and that's because these young players were blooded a long time ago, and you can go all the way back to the John Toshak era, when players like Gareth Bale and Aaron Ramsey were getting their first opportunities in the first team. Wales have given opportunities to young players as quickly as possible. Cynics might suggest that it's also to make sure they don't end up playing for England or someone else who they might be eligible for at international level. But it means that you get these players, many of whom are only playing championship football, and many of whom are very young, but have a huge weight of international experience behind them. And I think what has particularly changed for Wales in the last few months, you go back to last year, some really disappointing results in qualifying, losing at home to Armenia. And then this miraculous win over Croatia in October that just, completely transformed the qualifying campaign. But what has changed even since then is that almost all of Wales's most important players are now playing regular football. A lot of them have had to drop down to the championship, in search of football. You look at the Leeds contingent, Joe Rodon, Ethan Ampadu, Connor Roberts, Daniel James, they're all getting regular football. David Brooks is getting regular football with Southampton. Kiefer Moore is getting regular football and banging the goals in with Ipswich. And, Aaron Ramsey didn't feature against Finland. He was on the bench. He's working his way back after a knee injury. But you don't feel like Wales are dependent on him in the way that they once were. Obviously not dependent on Gareth Bale anymore either. But there's this new group of players who've come through, and that they're all playing regular football. They're pretty much all in decent form, and it gives Rob Page a bit of a selection headache, when it comes to sending his team out. So yeah, I feel like there is, even compared to the positive results Wales had towards the back end of last year, there's even greater competition for places now. And the fact that no one's really talking about whether or not Ramsey's going to start against Poland shows the position of strength that Wales are in. We played with a midfield pairing of 23-year-old Ethan Ampadu and 19-year-old Jordan James against Finland, and they were both absolutely brilliant. You've got Wilson, you've got Johnson, you've got David Brooks and all the rest of them. So, yeah, I mean, it's all very positive.
Excellent. Tom, you're going along to the game Tuesday?
Yes, I will be there on Tuesday in the Ninian stand in what's become my habitual spot.
Very nice. Well, best of luck. I hope it goes well for you. And we'll catch up with you soon.
Yes, well, I think I'll catch up with you on Thursday, James. So we'll be able to post-mortem things in great detail.
All right, also on Tuesday, as mentioned, you've got Georgia against Greece and Ukraine versus Iceland, which is taking place in Wroclaw, Poland. What a turnaround for Ukraine in there. Semi-final against Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Yeah, late goals. And yeah, I mean, we had this with the World Cup playoff when Wales played Ukraine. This is obviously, for very obvious non-sporting reasons, there's this sort of rush of goodwill that Wales managed to trample all over and kind of fair play to them. But I think now Iceland kind of had their moment in 2016. I think pretty much everyone's behind Ukraine getting to this Euros. It would be a brilliant statement. And they look good at the moment. They look, the team that got dismantled by England at Euro 2020 seems to have had this sort of overhaul. And yeah, I don't know if it's driven by patriotic pride. I'm sure it is, but there's also a heck of a lot of talent in that Ukraine team. I really hope they make it, because they wouldn't be a...
When you see them attack, Dan, that there really is a lot of talent. Like, I know that we know Modric, obviously, because of the big transfer to Chelsea, and Dovbyk because of his season at Girona. But Georgi Sudakov behind them, you see the fees connected with him. And I saw him play a couple of times in the Champions League. Shakhtar played their games in Hamburg this season for obvious reasons. And if you can get that firing, I mean, it's not a huge surprise. I right before you started recording, they only lost to Italy and England in 2023. And if you think back to that second leg playoff game against Italy in Leverkusen, really, they should have had a penalty at the end of it. And they were probably the better team throughout. They drew against Germany. They beat North Macedonia in North Macedonia, which is no mean feat. They're talented. So they're this, obviously, a story that everybody can get behind. But you really wouldn't want to face them at this stage of a qualification campaign.
Mm. Iceland have Alba Gudmundsson, meanwhile. He might be commanding big transfer fees of his own this summer. Been a bit of a breakout star this season for Genoa. And he continued that in their 4-1 win in their semi-final against Israel, played in Budapest, again, for obvious reasons, notching up a hat trick. Anyway, there you go. That's the game at 7:45 on Tuesday. A couple of hours before that, Georgia faced Greece, a game which you're quite invested in, Daniel.
Yeah, I spent some time with a guy called David Webb, who's one of the assistant coaches for Willy Sagnol, the Georgia manager now. And I mean, the country in general is really investing in football. It's used the Nations League to, not miraculous effect, but certainly to fairly seismic effect. They are now in League B, which is England's league. They got promoted out of D and got promoted out of C. In both campaigns, they won 5 and drew 1. That league that they just got promoted out, they dismantled Bulgaria, for example, who were not what they were. But this idea that Europe's minnows is beyond maybe two or three very obvious nations now is absolutely right. Georgia are there to make up the gap. I really hope they beat Greece, because I'm in the nicest possible way, I'm sick of watching Greece draw 0-0 major tournament matches live. And yeah, I just think that there's this huge movement behind Georgian football at the moment. Not obviously, not least because of Kvaradona, but also because the squad is now filled with players who are at decent clubs at decent level and getting minutes at those clubs as well. They joint hosted the European Under 21 Championships last summer. They invested in stadiums for that. David Webb says that it's not quite Premier League facilities, but it's not far off. The structure is there for Georgia to bridge the gap, and something like the Nations League makes a huge difference, because it will be years, maybe even decades, before they have a chance, a serious chance in regular qualifying. But they've lost one Euro playoff final. They're desperate not to lose another. They will be second favourites against Greece, but they're also at home, which will make a fairly big difference in Tbilisi. It's 60,000 people. It's a mad atmosphere. So, yeah, I'd like them in Ukraine to win, please.
Mm. I felt terribly sorry for Luxembourg in that playoff. Georgia played very well, and they probably deserved it. But Luxembourg, a mirror image of the journey that Georgia have been on. They were ranked 195th, so that's kind of between countries like Montserrat and American Samoa. American Samoa of 31-0 fame. And really, Georgia played well and they did deserve to win, but really should have been down to 10 men in the first half, in my opinion. I thought that was pretty poorly officiated. They too have invested in young players. They've got a campaign to gather all the best 6-7-year-old players in the country in a kind of a central academy system. So they're really trying to kind of move up the ladder, and they're a great success story as well for them to get so close to a major competition, and then to kind of be let down by officials is got to be a pretty bitter pill to swallow. The Greece thing, I was reading up on this. Apparently Gus Poyet, who first of all didn't really know that Gus Poyet was coaching Greece, his contract runs out in 5 days' time. Did we know that?
Good Lord, I was not aware of that.
So this is kind of pretty pivotal for him. And they haven't been, I think they've been to one European Championship since they won it. And that was back in, they got to the quarterfinals in 2012. They've been to one World Cup. The last World Cup they were at was 2014. So this would be a pretty big moment for them too. And obviously, it's kind of further employment or bust for Poyet by all accounts. So Yeah, it's a strange situation if you've got sort of 4 days left on the job before you, you know, either go to a European Championship or you find yourself somewhere else to work.
Well, I guess the timing makes sense from the point of view they might be out of contention for the Euros post Tuesday, and therefore time to make that change. By the way, for all that nil-nil fame that Daniel was referencing, 5-0 their win against Kazakhstan last Thursday. They were 4-0 up at half-time. So,
maybe this is it. Maybe it's Gus Poyet's Kevin Keegan entertainers, and I've got them all wrong.
All of the goals they scored, barring the penalty, were kind of the same. They all came from the right side against Kazakhstan. They all came from crosses not being cut out or space not being taken away. So it wasn't... I think Kazakhstan probably claims to be better than they showed. But Greece were pretty good. If you schedule someone's contract to coincide with non-qualification for a tournament, isn't that quite negative? Like, well, we won't need to employ you beyond that because, you know, there's no need. Does that fire you up?
Well, we'll see if it works. Perhaps it does. Everything on the line.
I'll remind you of this Greece loving
horrible agenda.
when the group stage comes around and you're all being sick because they've drawn 0-0 with Czech Republic.
If they get through, potentially in a group with Turkey as well, which would be a pretty incendiary fixture for obvious reasons. So that's another incentive for the Greeks.
That game would also be in the Westfalen Stadion, which would be a heck of an atmosphere for a group game at the Euros.
You're talking yourself into the Greece.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm talking myself into a win-win situation, James. That's all. That's good.
Very nice. All right. Well, loads to look forward to on Tuesday. There were other big stories around the world of international football over this weekend, not least events between France and Germany. And we'll get onto that next.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Football Content Awards International Podcast of the Year.
Full-time Europe, The Athletic's women's football podcast, will be out on Tuesday. It was a big weekend in the WSL, as you probably know. Derbies in Liverpool and Manchester, where Man City women made it 11 WSL wins in a row with a 3-1 win over their United counterparts. Loads on that then in full-time Europe. What else happened this weekend? Oof, Leicester City now officially charged by the Premier League with breaking spending rules during their last three seasons in the top flight. Foxes could now face a points deduction next season. And they're also subject of a separate financial probe from the EFL, presumably what, relating to their current activities in the Championship. Is that right?
Yeah, and they haven't submitted their accounts. I mean, this is a very, very simplified version of it, but it does sort of sound to the layperson like they're saying to the Premier League, well, we're in the EFL, and they're saying to the EFL, well, all those punishments were from when we were in the Premier League. So, checkmate.
Checkmate indeed. Meanwhile, on a happier note, congratulations to Chesterfield, who confirmed promotion from the National League back to the EFL on Saturday by beating Bournemouth 3-0. That's my little homage to Chesterfield manager Paul Cook, he of the extraordinary octaval range in post-game interviews.
You watch us today and again, it's the same things that come out of the game that we don't have to discuss game after game. We've just got to stay as positive as we can now for as long as we can.
He made the save.
You know, I don't feel we've worked Oldham's goalkeeper anywhere near enough, but it looked like it was Peter now to a 1-0 win.
Possibly the biggest post-game interview gear shift since, what, Frank Lampard?
It's like a different character. Probably. It's incredible.
Mm.
Well, it reminded me a little bit of that, do you remember that Australian, I think it was an Australian senator or something, who is talking about diversity and then starts talking about crocodile deaths in the same breath. It's the most Australian Frank Lampard turn you can ever imagine. I've made it sound 10% as good as it is.
People are entitled to their sexual proclivities, you know. I mean, let there be 1,000 blossoms bloom as far as I'm concerned, you know. But I ain't spending any time on it, because in the meantime, every 3 months, a person is torn to pieces by a crocodile in North Queensland.
The kind of the Jeff Buckley of non-league English football with his octave leap. I'm interested to hear an explanation for it more than anything else. Daniel?
I have no explanation other than it is magnificent. I'm actually hoping to go and see Chesterfield this week.
Cool.
So I mean, that's question number one.
Just to underline, remarkable. They got promotion back to the AFL on the 23rd of March. That's how much they've dominated the National League. Now, other friendlies. France faced Germany Saturday evening. And Seb, just when everyone else thought it was safe to go to a Euros in Germany, the Mannschaft is back.
Be very careful. Hey, Jimbo, the thing about this, though, is that, and this really describes how fragile Germany is feeling about its football. On Saturday evening, everyone was very, very happy. Best German performance they've seen in ages. Well done, Julian Nagelsmann. Let's applaud the meritocracy involving all these Stuttgart players. Toni Kroos is back. Fantastic. By Sunday morning, the lead headline on Bild was, were we that good, or were France bad? And so some of the optimism had been wound back just a little bit. But hey, they were excellent. They really were. There were some flaws. There were a few moments when Kylian Mbappe and Ousmane Dembele were a little bit menacing around the flanks against Joshua Kimmich and Maxim Mittelstadt. But the roots of Nagelsmann's football were there. The ball movement was very, very good. The front three in particular. So Nagelsmann started with Kai Havertz playing a sort of a, I suppose you probably call it a false nine because he did a lot of drifting, with Florian Wirtz and Jamal Musiala playing behind as a kind of a dueling number 10 system. Worked fantastically well. Havertz played beautifully, dropping off the play, passing the ball really nicely. Wirtz, to me, he's at that stage of his career where people still don't quite appreciate how good he is. He's been wrapped up in the Leverkusen story. He's a kind of a character within that tale rather than a player in his own right. He was fabulous against France, scored an excellent goal, played with this kind of, you know, and players are able just to speed up a game, slow it down, play at their own speed, make it look quite easy, play on the transition, do all the things that you'd want to see in a Nagelsmann system. And yeah, they were excellent. They also, one of the better stories from it was the fullback, Maxim Mittelstadt, who is a beneficiary of what Stuttgart have been able to do this season under Sebastian Hoeneß. They've been excellent, but his journey over the past year has been amazing. So go back to 2023, and he was part of a Hertha Berlin side who were circling the drain and heading down the Bundesliga plug hole. And no one saw him as anything other than a future Zweite Bundesliga fullback. So much so that when he left Hertha in the summer, it was for €500,000, came to Stuttgart with nobody really paying any attention. And it's been reinvented as this, he's not a dynamic player. He's not a sort of a left-sided Kyle Walker type. He doesn't have pace. And to be fair, that was something that Dembele exploited a little bit in the friendly in Lyon. But can play internally, can pass the ball, can be part of the sort of the build-up phases that Germany have lacked in their chance creation over the last few years. Because the big issues affecting the German national team, under the umbrella of the German people being massively disinterested in it as it becomes less and less successful, is chance creation, can't score goals, no number nine, can't defend. Also, permanent crisis about whether Manuel Neuer or Marc-Andre Ter Stegen should be playing goal.
Right.
And for the first time, really, on Saturday night, that story moved forward. You could envisage a situation where Germany don't maybe win the European Championship, but they're a problem. They're not going to be a source of embarrassment in the kind of the sense that the Deutsche Bahn doesn't work and here's another thing we've got to worry about because we might humiliate ourselves on the world stage. They were very, very good, and they deserve all their praise, all the praise they're receiving. And no, France weren't terrific. France were, you know, what they are outside of tournaments, but it was really, really encouraging.
Okay, and it started early, didn't it? 7 seconds into the game, Florian Wirtz scoring, and this wasn't an accident, eh?
No accident, Jimbo. Jamal Musiala was talking to the media afterwards, and he said that one of their coaches, who's a specialist in creating automatisms within open play, had kind of put it to the players on Friday. This is what we're going to do from kickoff. We're going to get it to Toni Kroos, which is a pretty good starting point, isn't it? One of the best passers in world football. He's going to find Florian Wirtz, and then it's going to be kind of, right, Flo, do your worst.
Los geht's, passt das Ganze, gibt es endlich eine Aufbruchstimmung, 83 Tage vor dem Eröffnungsspiel. Es gibt den ersten Torschuss und den ersten Treffer, 8 Sekunden, Florian Wirtz.
And it worked, because it was
so
pretty
effective.
So the
plan was, pass to Florian Wirtz and see if he can score a goal?
See if he can score a goal. That seemed to be, so you could probably find more complex strategies, but you can't really argue with it.
That's what specialists in creating automatisms?
Automatisms. It's like if John McKenzie was here, that's what he would call it. So I'm doing my best impression of him.
What does it mean?
It means you kind of, within open play, you have set passages. So you might have a situation where, I don't know, for instance, you're trying to push a winger into space or full back into space. So a ball might be planned to go into midfield and then be swept out to the flank by an Andrea Pirlo type. So there are little moments in the game which are kind of like strategies that repeat and repeat. So think of Antonio Conte's football. That's a really good example. Sort of loads of circuits, loads of the same thing happening again and again and again. And this was just one of those. This was a kind of, we're going to put Wirtz into space. We're going to put him 25, 30 yards away from goal. And we're going to ask him to do his worst. And he did. And I have to say, like, I thought of Dan, because Bryce Samba played in goal for France. And he was absolutely excellent. He made 3 or 4 of the best saves I saw all weekend. And should have paid him, Dan.
Yeah, the one that got it. I mean, the good thing is that Forest are very much doing this sort of Panini sticker album of European goalkeepers now. So we've already had him. We're working through Belgium now with Matt Sells, and Greece as well, of Vlachos Kolymos. And yeah, never mind, the one that got away. I was about to say, on that early goal, this is a bit of a hot take, but 152 years of international football, for both the fastest and the second fastest goals of all time in international football to be on the same day. That's like the most incredible quirk of fate in football history, surely.
Is there something behind it, or do you think it really is just an enormous coincidence? The other goal that you referenced took place a couple of hours before the Wirtz goal, and it was Christoph Baumgartner for Austria scoring after 6 seconds against Slovakia.
Und nach vorne ist das richtige Stichwort der Österreicher. Ja, bist du denn verrückt? 6 Sekunden gespielt. Christoph Baumgartner.
I suppose if you overanalyze it, you'd say, well, if you're a manager, international manager, you might say it's a friendly. They might switch off during the first 6 seconds, not expecting something mad to happen. And I think you'd also say, if you were being a cynic and a critic, you'd say, why are you using that up in a international friendly? Save that for the first group stage of the Euros. But I just, it's the most astonishing fact I can think of.
That I'm going to make a really tenuous leap and say that, and this is going to stand no scrutiny whatsoever, but
good.
Both teams, one coached by Julian Nagelsmann, the other coached by Ralf Rangnick, both high priests of vertical transition football. I don't think that stands up to any sort of analysis, but it adds into the kind of coincidence, right?
I can't imagine two more managers in the world who would be more pleased with that coming off than those two.
Rangnick's effect on Austria is amazing. I did a bit of work a couple of months ago, and obviously sort of he's the beneficiary of having a lot of players who have either played within the Red Bull system or have been exposed to tenets of Red Bull football. But like socially, if you look at kind of the attendance of national team games, it's gone through the roof. It wasn't so long ago that big sinkhole appeared within the Austrian national stadium during an international break, which is kind of a handy metaphor for where they are under Franco Foda. So you've changed from being a team which had attacking players but preferred to play a counter-attacking, carrying, very, very conservative style of play, to something much more modern and recognisable, and something which also, I suppose, if you were Austrian, would inspire a little bit more of an emotional response from you if you're watching it. And I spoke to an Austrian journalist who said that, you know, Rangnick also puts a lot more faith in domestic players than Foda did. And you know, that's really, really resonated with the sporting public. So they're a really good story heading into the Euros.
It'd be good for Jim Radcliffe to watch the Euros and pick between Southgate and Rangnick as his next Manchester United manager, won't it?
It's a good idea, Daniel. Germany, meanwhile, are going to be hosting the Netherlands on Tuesday, which is another big fixture. See what the headlines are like after that one, Seb. The Dutch, who of course saw off Scotland Friday night 4-0, although that scoreline.
The Scotland were better than that, a little bit. Jimbo. And this was a, if you were to imagine a Ronald Koeman coached team with a lot of talent playing beneath themselves, this is what that game looks like. Because they really weren't that good. They're an awful lot of very, very talented players in that group. But I've never been particularly enraptured by what they've done under Koeman. But I thought Scotland deserved a little bit better than a 4-0 thumping. They played better than that.
All right, it was a wonderful goal from Rangers, though.
Sure was. It sure was, yeah.
In terms of wonderful goals, you'll also no doubt have seen Daniel Munoz for Colombia against Spain in a game that weirdly took place at the London Stadium in East London. And did you catch the Damashan goal for Moldova against North Macedonia?
No, sir.
Or do? North Macedonia 1, Moldova 1, and Vitali Damashan with the standout goal, I would say, of the weekend.
Can you describe it?
No. Do you know what? As I was saying, I can't actually remember what this looks like, just that it was amazing. I think it's really, really, really curling. But there were a lot of goals by players that I wasn't 100% familiar with in games, which I'm not sure that I've fully filed properly in my head. It's one of those. I'm
the reaction
go check
to
it
the
out
Munoz goal was lovely. Behind what you saw, the kind of Colombians fans. So the goal itself was fantastic, of course, but the kind of the response to it was not very friendly-like, which is exactly what you want to see, right? And it was, it was impassioned. It was excellent.
Very nice. One other thing we should mention, Portugal, if they're on your radar as potential threats this summer in Germany, they took on Sweden this weekend. They beat them 5-2. They won all of their last 11 matches under Roberto Martinez, so yeah, keep an eye on them. Magnificent. That's the international break so far. Tuesday's going to see some mighty games, and we will be catching up on the results of those in Thursday's show. So do hope you'll be returning for that, listener. Many thanks in the meantime to Daniel and Seb, Christoph and Tom, and producer Charlie for making today possible. Hope you have a splendid rest of your weekend stroke start of your week. And we'll catch up with you Thursday.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.